Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with David Head about his book about the use of the United States as a base for privateering in the early 19th century, entitled Privateers of the Americas, Spanish-American Privateering from the United States in the Early Republic. David, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here today.
We're delighted to have you. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
So I am originally from Western New York. I grew up in the Buffalo area, and I moved down to Florida in 2010 after finishing my PhD at the University of Buffalo. And I can tell you that December in Florida is much different than December in Buffalo. So it's a very different experience. It feels like April used to feel. So it's wonderful. So I enjoy being here this time of year. It's great.
Does that make up for hurricane season?
Yes, I suppose it does. They don't come all that often, so you kind of forget about it and enjoy your months of nice mild weather here, so it's great.
So how did you come to write this book?
So the book is a revised version of my dissertation, and I went to grad school at the University of Buffalo, and I wanted to write about pirates. That was my goal, but I needed to find some pirates to write about. So I tried a couple of different ideas as I was early in grad school, and eventually I landed on an episode of sort of illegal privateering that came up in the 18-teens as people in the United States served in the Spanish-American Wars of Independence of that time, which was a violation of U.S. law to participate in a foreign war. I found some articles about this episode of privateering, but they're principally from like the 1920s, 1940s, so stuff that was old hadn't been done for a while. So that's good. It was not like someone else had done it recently. Then, as I continued digging, I found that there was a lot of records. So because what these privateers did was illegal, they often were prosecuted in U.S. courts, sued in U.S. courts, and their records were preserved by the National Archives as part of their federal court records that they preserve. So different branches around the country have these records, and no one had really looked at them very, very much over the years. They've just been sitting there waiting for someone to find them. And they had great stories. They had details from the voyages. All the participants would give testimony, give depositions. So you have from the captains, from the investors, the owners. Sometimes you get the sailors themselves, so you rarely get a glimpse of what their experience was. And so just wonderfully rich sources that I was able to find. So we put those two things together, and I had a great story that I was able to tell that no one had done recently. So that's how I came to decide to write about the privateers in the early 19th century.
As you explain in your book, you have this very unusual world. It's we sometimes think of the early republic. We think of the young nation. We think about the westward expansion and so forth. And you describe a dynamic that sometimes gets overlooked, which was the relationship with what we now call Latin America, the dynamic of the revolutions that were taking place there. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain a bit that context and this issue of privateering and how Americans came to be involved with it.
Okay, so the Spanish-American, Latin American Wars of Independence, they really touched off in 1808 as an outgrowth of the Napoleonic Wars. So, of course, Napoleon is at war all the time in Europe, trying to conquer as much of the continent as he can. And one of the things he does is to invade Spain. He imprisons the Spanish king and puts his brother on the throne instead. The Spanish people in both Spain and in the colonies in the Americas, one response is to resist having Napoleon really ruling Spain. So they form these governing councils to rule in the king's name. So at first it was to resist France on behalf of the king. But some people in Spanish America, they wanted more. They wanted more autonomy. They wanted independence. So they begin using this event to push for independence. So those Spanish Americans who are seeking independence, they're really fighting against France for a time and against other people in Spain who want to keep control over the colonies. In the 19th century, like in the 18th century before, whenever there was a war, there was privateering. So a privateer is a privately owned vessel that receives a license to attack enemies. And the reason that country would do this is that it augments their naval power, right? Anyone who's owned a boat knows that boats are really expensive to maintain and to keep and to build and all that. So countries, they wouldn't keep a large navy during peacetime. They would just call into action these privately owned vessels by giving them a privateering commission. The incentive for privateers was that they got to keep what they captured. They go through a legal process, a court hearing, and then if everything, you know, everything checked out, they got to keep the goods that they captured. So in many ways, this was just, this is what countries did in the 19th century. They commissioned privateers. The Latin American countries, however, they didn't have a large merchant marine of their own. Most of their foreign trade had been carried in British ships or in American ships. So they, when they're looking to add to their naval force, they had to look abroad. And Americans who had a privateering experience in the War of 1812, for example, they were like prime candidates to become privateers. And Latin American countries reach out to them in various ways and enlist their aid. So that's the larger context of how Americans became involved in the Spanish-American Wars of Independence as privateers.
As you explain, this gets tangled up with international politics, not just the issue of Spain trying to regain control over their colonies after the Napoleonic Wars, but at the same time, you also have the United States engaged with a set of negotiations with Spain to acquire Florida, to basically maintain good relations with a European power. And so you have, you know, John Quincy Adams engaged in these negotiations, and yet you also have these Americans who are engaged in these acts of hostility against the Spanish flag.
Yeah, so it touches on a number of different considerations. The treaty negotiations that were underway, it has the potential to kind of irritate those negotiations. The Spanish minister is always angry that the United States doesn't do more to restrain Americans from participating in the Spanish-American Wars of Independence. The United States pledges its neutrality during the war, which means that the United States recognizes a war exists, and they're obligated to treat both sides equally. And so they want to stay out of this. Even though there are domestic pressures to become more involved, the Latin American Wars of Independence is popular in the United States. People would generally like to see the independence movement succeed. So they have to walk a tightrope between different considerations. And you know, here it's important to remember the United States is a weak power in this period. It's not like the United States can just impose its will on other places, former Spanish colonies, Spain, and all that. They have to be very careful about where the United States exerts its power, because it could entangle the United States into a larger conflict with the European powers. And, you know, we're victorious over the British. We're not really victorious, but didn't lose to the British in the War of 1812. That's a fine distinction. People in 1815 thought the United States was victorious because Andrew Jackson won the last battle and everything. But they didn't lose. But, you know, if they get involved in another war, they might not be so lucky again. So that's certainly consideration that's in the background, touching all these different particular issues with the privateers.
And it's that point about weaknesses is one that stands out in your book, not just in terms of America's relationships with Spain and and other countries, but also in terms of America's effort to control their own borders. It's one of the themes that runs through the various chapters, is how they're engaging this effort to, in effect, establish or maintain this national authority in this area where they have far more land than they have people, where people are very independent and are, you know, perfectly willing to flaunt, defy, and evade American authority in pursuit of these profits.
Yes, that's certainly something you see. You mentioned just the vast territory, right? One of the things I think is interesting too, it's not just, you know, on the borders out in the middle of nowhere where there aren't any authorities, where you can just move across the border with Spain or wherever. It's also like in the ports that these guys are able to take advantage of some of the weaknesses in the law. So, for example, some of these privateers, as an aspect of U.S. neutrality, they have access to U.S. ports, and especially if they're what's called in distress. So if, you know, the ship is sinking or it's lost its rigging or it's out of water or food, the Spanish-American vessels can go into United States ports and they can get repairs and replenished and all that. They can actually sell some of their cargo to pay for what they need to have done. And that makes sense, right, because you don't want to have rules where guys just drown at sea because they can't come into port. But the one unintended consequence of that is that these guys can get into port legally. And then once they're in port, you know, all kinds of things can happen. So even under the various, right under the eyes of authorities, they can be there and offload their goods, you know, right at the port. So it's not necessarily just out in the middle of nowhere. It's right in the port of Baltimore, in the port of New Orleans. They can do these kinds of things to take advantage of those laws about being in distress. And being a neutral means you have to welcome, right, both sides to be able to have access to your ports. So they're very, very clever about using the law, kind of loopholes in the law, using the law against itself to achieve their goals.
One of the things I really liked about your book was that you focus on four geographic areas, the New Orleans area, Baltimore, Galveston, and Amelia Island. And in each of these areas, the dynamics are a little different, and they point to the various ways in which privateering operated. For New Orleans, for example, you're talking about a port which has just recently been taken over by the United States. It's on the Mississippi River. You have the Mississippi Delta. And you describe how there was this, you know, thriving smuggling operation. You had actors like the Lafittes who were very entrepreneurial in their approach, and how the amount of opportunities they had far outstripped the ability of these customs inspectors to assert any sort of control over the process.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In New Orleans, the geography is critical. Some listeners may have been to New Orleans. It's like 100 miles or so up the Mississippi River from the coast. I mean, so there's a lot of territory there that's just not patrolled, not policed in any meaningful way. So you can easily, sail into the bayous in the backcountry there and get to the Mississippi River and down to New Orleans without encountering any kind of authority. So that's part of the secret to their success. There's just lots of ways to access New Orleans without anyone seeing. Another sort of perhaps unappreciated or underappreciated factor about the geography there is the fact that the Gulf Coast region there, New Orleans and Louisiana, they're right next to Spanish territory, especially in Spanish West Florida at the time, which is now the bottom parts of Alabama and Mississippi, the panhandle of Florida. That was all the Spanish province of West Florida. So the laws there are different. For example, the slave trade was still practiced, the international slave trade, so slaves being brought in from abroad, was still legal in parts of West Florida. At the same time, it was illegal in the United States, in Louisiana. So it was easy enough for people like the Lafittes to go over to some place like Pensacola, buy slaves legally, and then transport them again through the backcountry into Louisiana. So both the geography in the sense that there's just lots of empty space where you can operate outside the eyes of the law, but also when there are laws, they're different very close by across the border that can be used effectively by these guys who want to they're able to make money off of this by a willingness to break U.S. law, to give people the kinds of things that they want.
You described the Lafittes there, and I was struck by how much it was like organized crime, how they would take a percentage off the top and they would provide a degree of protection. And they were very comfortable with using violence. And you set up the contrast between the Lafittes and, on the one hand, and then the U.S. customs officials on the other, who are oftentimes very much at sea. And I also liked how you incorporate into that the United States Navy, who was comfortable with violence, but as you explain, they were hardly comfortable with the role that they were being asked to play.
Right. The guys on the naval patrol, the Navy guys on patrol in the Gulf region there, they do not want to be there. Part of it is just it's uncomfortable, they're far from home, but really they're concerned about their careers because they are assigned to this gunboat duty. So there's an idea that some policymakers have that gunboats, so small vessels, a couple dozen guys patrolling that's a better kind of more efficient use of resources in the Navy, just to protect the coastal region and to, patrol for smugglers and pirates and that thing. But the naval officers, they find that guys who have a lot of gunboat duty, they don't get promoted. So New Orleans is where naval careers go to die, and they're afraid that they'll be stuck there. And there's a scholar who did a study of this and found that, yes, actually guys who went through that station were promoted less frequently. It took them longer to be promoted because of the duty on the gunboats, because the Navy guys, they respect sailing at sea and being a real seaman out in the open ocean, not by the river. You don't have any skills for that. So those guys are not happy, and that contributes to a lack of interest in enforcing the laws even when they could. There's a wonderful quote I found from a naval officer. He's reflecting backwards on his career from later in time. And he says, he was happy when the United States went to war with Britain because finally he had an opportunity to distinguish himself fighting the British, a real opponent, not just cruising along the rivers and the Gulf Coast region looking for pirates. So they, even when there were assets there that could have intercepted the trade, there are reasons, various good reasons for them, not to be well motivated.
And yet the dynamic in Baltimore was very different from that. Whereas that is a place that is more comfortable. Maryland is part of the original 13 states. And you're having a much more settled, established community. It's closer to federal authority. And so you describe a very different set of dynamics at play about how you have these established businessmen who are engaging in the trade and who are able to use the law very much in various ways to have this veneer of legality to these what were basically illegal actions.
Right. So the Baltimore operations are a much larger scale. And you're right, part of that is because they're in Baltimore, a more settled area. Is it close to the seat of federal power? That's not, on the frontier region or any close to Spanish territory. So some of those options are not there the way they had been in a place like Louisiana. And it is much more of a sort of capital intensive business. The ships are bigger, which means they're more expensive. They go on longer voyages, which again means you need to have more investment to get them equipped and supplied and all that kind of thing. And the men who operate those privateers from Baltimore, I think they're really using the law in a much more sophisticated way. So the Lafittes, for example, that's the way they operate. These guys in Baltimore, some of the owners there, they're going to be there for long term. Some of the captains, they have families, they're settled and rooted in that community. So when they're trying to get their making money on this, they're claiming that they're doing this legally, that they're participating with legal commission. Some of them claim that they have expatriated themselves, that they have given up their U.S. citizenship and become citizens of one of the Spanish American republics. So now they're not participating illegally in a foreign war. It's their war because they're citizens of another country. So they use the law to use the law to their advantage and operate as much like a business within the law as possible. So it's a much more sophisticated, sort of intensive operation they have in Baltimore.
That was one of the points that really stood out for me when I was reading it, was the fluidity of so much. And nowadays, we think of national identity as being this thing that you hold on to, that giving it up is not especially if we think of in our country surrendering American identity as a very big deal and not something to be done lightly. And yet these people would be willing to change their nationalities like they would change their clothes, in part because it seems that they were comfortable and in knowing that they could change it back when it suited them, that this was going to be in their minds at least, a temporary change while they engage in this activity and enrich themselves.
Yes, I think one of the interesting things to me, one of the things I found most meaningful as I did the research was to find guys who, it seems like at the beginning, they were going to adopt this kind of Spanish-American identity just for convenience so that they could get around the law, so they wouldn't end up in jail, that they could undertake some kind of voyage that would be profitable. But then it seems like over time, they adopted more and more of a sense of an affinity for Spanish America itself, or at least Spanish American independence. Part of that might have been an outgrowth of seeing the American model of independence embodied in Spanish America. That was something that was kind of a fad in the United States in the 1810s and 1820s, was the enthusiastic supporters of Latin American independence movements as, you know, sort of the second coming of the American Revolution. But you do see some guys, some of the captains in particular, a man named James Chater was really interesting to me. He starts calling himself Diego Chater, and he signs letters DC. And he does this to business associates. He goes back and forth, JC, DC. And he also signs a letter or two to his wife. He signs it DC, which indicates to me, he's not fooling her that his name is really Diego or something. But it seems to be that it's something that he kind of slipped into without really thinking about it. So you're right, there's this kind of change in their identities, their affiliations. And I think it really emerges through their experience as privateers. And for some, it's no doubt calculated just to be able to do what they want and avoid the law. But for others, it seems to be something that they really take to heart. And that was probably one of the most interesting findings that I had through the research.
Another figure that stood out for me was John Daniel Dennels, who not only, you know, like so many of these other individuals, adopts a, you know, basically a different citizenship of in order to stay right with the law, but also he eventually rises up and becomes an officer in the liberation movement and may even, as you mentioned, have met Simón Bolívar himself.
Yes, yeah, he's one of the best characters in the book. You know, there's a wonderful painting that I found that the Maryland Historical Society has that he commissioned a painting of himself in a Colombian naval uniform. And so that's how he wanted to present himself, is in the Colombian uniform. He's a wonderful guy. Wonderful in the sense of being interesting. He has many negative characteristics. He appears to be very cruel to his crew. He thinks that he can kind of bully them. He's a really interesting incident where some guys had escaped from his crew, and when he was in South America, he runs across them in the street of Baltimore, and he threatens them. He threatens to flog them, but he apparently threatened them by saying if he ever saw them in South America, he would flog them. So knowing that he can't get away with this in Baltimore, but he could in South America, where he is more important than he would be in Baltimore. And yeah, he seems to have that the title that he gained in the Colombian service, Commodore. He carries that around with him for the rest of his life. I imagine he was like Jack Sparrow in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, always insists on being called Captain. Right? Daniels, I just imagine him always insisting on being called Commodore Daniels, and that's the title he carries with him for the rest of his days.
It really does suggest a no small amount of pride in the rank he had attained and his activities. That it wasn't something to be ashamed of, to be doing this privateering. And that's another aspect of the book I thought was really interesting, was the degree to which these people were maybe not quite heroes, but definitely not proud, not ashamed of, you know, engaging, fighting for these liberation causes, and engaging in this criminal activity. And I'm wondering if that might have been because they saw it as not criminal activity against the United States, but criminal activity against Spain.
Exactly. I think that Spanish American independence is popular in the United States, and it's fighting against old Spain, the monarchy. And yes, it might have violated the law, but it was in the right cause, is probably the perception that people had. And you're right. Yeah, you're right. He does. I mean, he owns that title, and certainly that's the way he presented himself for the rest of his life. He got sued all the time because of what he did in the moment. I can't remember offhand if he's prosecuted, but he doesn't certainly never even if he was were prosecuted, he didn't go to prison or anything like that. So there are no negative consequences in that way. And he comes out of it, a fairly wealthy man, certainly comfortable, and he's able to provide for a large family. He names one of his sons Bolivar, which is really, really interesting. That was another thing that was a fad in the 1820s was to name a son Bolivar. But for him, he actually met, he most likely met Simon Bolivar himself. So a little bit different category there. But yeah, he's a great character in the story.
You just mentioned another interesting dynamic too in your book, which is how so many of these merchant captains went after these privateers, because we think of privateering in terms of criminal activity, and you describe the effort by federal authorities to criminally prosecute these individuals and how that was not necessarily successful. But you describe how these captains were much more successful going after them with civil claims. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk about that judicial dynamic and how that played out in the United States.
Right. So there are any number of cases on both sides. So there's the criminal prosecutions and the civil lawsuits. And one of the things I found is that criminal prosecutions are not very successful. There's only a handful of men who are convicted. They're charged with a number of crimes, piracy, slave trading, violating U.S. neutrality law, because it's a kind of crime to participate in a war against a power that's at peace with the United States. So going to war against Spain was illegal. The only time anybody seriously punished is if there's a mutiny involved, for example. There are several cases where ordinary sailors mutinied. They may have murdered someone along the way. I don't remember the exact details. And there are a few of those cases where they are convicted of piracy, and then a handful of them are executed. But the captains, the investors, the higher-level guys, they're not prosecuted. Or they are prosecuted, but it's not successful. And, of course, there's no indication. We don't have the jury's deliberations or anything like that. So we don't know exactly what was going on. On the other side, on the civil side, however, what usually happens is that the former owners of the property, usually a Spanish merchant, they will sue to get their property back on the grounds that their property was captured by a privateer operating against U.S. law. And so that's the point of contact for the U.S. legal system to get involved, is that there's a violation of American law that preceded these captures. Those are more often successful. And one of the differences in the way the cases are handled is that the civil cases proceed under admiralty law, which in admiralty law, there's no jury. So it's only the judge makes the decision. So it seems that might be one difference, that a judge is more willing to agree to the Spanish arguments in the case, and may have less sympathy for the American captains who are engaged in privateering. So that's certainly a possibility. At the same time, I think I wouldn't necessarily reach the conclusion that in criminal matters, the juries were so sympathetic that they overlooked violations. Because one of the elements that the prosecution has to make out is intent. So all these laws involved, you have to be knowingly intending to take property that you know isn't yours. And one of the legal defenses that the privateers mount is, well, we were acting under a commission from one of the Spanish American countries. So in our minds, we were doing this legally. And again, without any direct evidence, I think that's a strong possibility that juries were accepting that argument, that even if they weren't taking, even if they were taking something that wasn't theirs, they lacked the sufficient intent that would make it into piracy and involved with capital crime and execution and all that kind of thing. So the two different sides are really interesting. If you just looked at prosecutions, then I think you get a misleading image of what the ability of U.S. authorities was to kind of crack down on this activity.
So what was it that brought this era of American privateering to an end?
So there are a number of factors. One set of factors were the geopolitics. So the wars were moving in a different direction. So by the 1820 or so, you really get a steep decline in privateering from the United States, in part because the Spanish-American countries are more successful than they had been previously. And it becomes very clear in the early 1820s that Spain just does not have the resources or the will to continue fighting to get back its colonies. It's going to take an enormous effort, and they're just not able to do it. Some of the officers, there's a coup in which they refuse to continue going over to South America. Perhaps coup isn't the right term, but they're refusing to go back, and that's really a sign that they're not going to be able to reconquer the Spanish-American colonies. So that's one dynamic that's changed. Once there aren't wars, then there's no more privateers. There's no reason to issue commissions. Another factor is in the United States, they changed the law. So there are some enhancements to the neutrality law to close up some of the loopholes that had existed. For example, one of the tricks that Baltimore operations used is that they would clear port, so they would get their official paperwork from the customs collector that they're going on a merchant voyage. And then they go down in the Chesapeake Bay before hitting the open ocean, and then they'd add more men, more supplies, and all that kind of thing, and they'd change the privateering after they got into the ocean. Well, one of the laws, for example, requires that if the customs collector suspects that there'll be a violation of U.S. neutrality, he can impose a bond on the ship. So if he sees that, you know, there are too many guys on this ship, there's too much food and supplies, you're not just going to a short trip to Cuba, you're probably going to be cruising for 6 months, he can require them to post bond, which then increases the amount of money committed to the voyage. So it drives up the cost significantly. Another kind of hidden factor here is, or unexpected factor, is the Panic of 1819, which strikes at first the banking system, and then it's a widespread, we'd call it a recession, I think, in today's terms. That really devastates the ability of some of the merchants to finance these operations. So they have, privateering is one of many different activities they have, and they don't have the capital anymore to invest in privateering because they've been devastated by the Panic of 1819. That was especially a major problem with the Baltimore investors in Baltimore privateers. So all those things come together, and they're able to control this problem by the 1820s. And you know, really by the 1820s, it's on a decline. Some Americans, they continue participating in the Spanish-American Wars of Independence. Commodore Danels, we mentioned before, he stops being a privateer and then goes and serves in the Colombian Navy. But overall, the numbers are way down by 1820.
Yeah, I think about how you end the book with Chater, who has had the successful career as a privateer, and you have him ending his days as a riverboat captain. It's kind of a very poignant mm-hmm. way of talking about, you know, sort of what you know, the end of this period and you know how prosaic the fate of some of these men were after it ended.
Right. So Chater is in contrast to Danels, and they I have their addresses in the early 18-teens. They live close together in the same neighborhood. And in the 1820s, Danels moves out to a much nicer neighborhood, much swankier address he has. And Chater stays in the same old neighborhood, the kind of sailor town down by the docks. So he's not as successful as Danels is. He's never able to make the same kind of money. He's not as fortunate. So he then has to go back to work once he gets back from he comes back finally from Spanish-American in the later 1820s. There was a time when he was pursuing a naval service in Colombia, and then he's thinking about Mexico maybe, and eventually comes home, and he has to continue working until he's an older man, becomes kind of like an old captain on the riverboat. He starts a business at one point, promising to give intelligence and information on anyone wanting to do business in South America. To kind of drawing on his experience that he had. And, you know, by the end, it seems that his earlier service in Spanish America was kind of forgotten. So not the same way Danels wore it as a badge of honor. Chaser seems to have kind of moved into obscurity towards the end of his life.
You mentioned how in his obituary, they describe, you know, Chaser as a sailor and all the things he's done, but they leave out any mention of privateering.
Right, yeah, that's not there anymore. Yeah. So that's from an earlier part of his life. It's not there anymore at the end, yeah.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
So I have a number of things that are coming out soon. So just in the last week or so, a long-term project I've been working on was published. That was the Encyclopedia of Atlantic World History. So I'm very excited to finally see that come to fruition. That's a multi-year project, multiple volumes, 200 some contributors. So that was nice to see come to conclusion. I have also been editing a collection of essays on pirates in the Golden Age in the 17th and 18th century. So that should be coming out from University of Georgia Press in June of 2018. So that's inching towards the finish line. And then my sort of long-term book project is a history of the Newburgh Conspiracy. So I'm kind of getting off the water, changing gears a little bit, and writing about an event at the end of the American Revolution when some of the officers in the Continental Army who were encamped near Newburgh, New York, they were getting angry, upset about they hadn't been paid in years, their pensions that they were promised may or may not actually come through. And there's this event where there's a call that goes out in camp to resist Congress in some way. And George Washington has to talk them down. There's a very famous incident, the way he resolves the problem. He puts on glasses at this address to his officers, and he remarks that he's grown gray and blind in their service, which makes everybody cry. So kind of fleshing out the full story there, talking about, was there really a conspiracy? How much of a threat was there of a coup or something like that? Trying to figure out some of those questions and really talking about the kind of ambiguous way the American Revolution ended in its last 2 years after Yorktown. And it ends in many ways unsatisfactory for the soldiers and the officers who fought the war. They go home feeling unappreciated. And then the longer term then is how that plays into the movement for a constitution and the reforms you see in the finances in the early republic. So that's what I'm working on now. Hopefully that'll be finished in not too distant future. But yeah, that's my work right now.
Well, those all sound like excellent projects. David, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Well, thanks again for having me.